Good afternoon. Today is the 5th of May 2008, and I'm now with Mr. Francis Alia Munu, who is Assistant Inspector General for Crime Services at the Sierra Leone Police Headquarters in Freetown, Sierra Leone. Well, first, thank you for your time, and before we start, I'd like you to please confirm that you've given your consent to the interview.
Yes, I have.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I'd like to start by asking you to give us a brief history of your personal career within the Sierra Leone Police and the positions you held before becoming AIG.
Okay, thank you very much. I was enlisted into the Sierra Leone Police on the 23rd of November 1984 as a Cadet Assistant Superintendent of Police, after I graduated from Furabe College, University of Sierra Leone, in 1982. I did 3 months of induction training at the police training school in Hastings, and I was sent on the job training for 3 years. I was posted to all the major departments of the Sierra Leone Police so as to get myself properly orientated to police work. And after 3 years, I was confirmed as Assistant Superintendent of Police and posted to Shebwema Police Station as Officer Commanding. Shebwema is in the eastern province of Sierra Leone. I had seven chiefdoms under my command, and my immediate supervisor was in Kailaung, the Chief Police Officer Kailaung. After 3 years, in 1987, I was advanced in rank to Deputy Superintendent of Police. I continued working in Shebwema until the outbreak of the rebel war in 1991. So effectively, I worked in Shebwema for 5 years, you know, from 1988 to 1992, when I was posted to Kabala, a second in command, you know. There again, I worked for 2 years. It was during the war, you know, we helped work with the military to execute the war. You know, we provided intelligence, you know, and we provided moral support, sometimes logistical support, sometimes advice, because we made sure that we shared our war related intelligence with the military commanders. You know, we helped raise the local militia in Koinadugu that were called the Tamabowo. They were used to repel the attack on Kono, you know, initially, and that was very successful. In 2004, I was posted to Kono as the officer in charge of Tankoro Police Station, which is at the heart of Koidu City, you know, the Diamond Rich area of Kono. I was there for 6 months, and there was a change of command at police headquarters, mm-hmm. and I was brought to be in charge of CID prosecutions. I was going to court, you know, prosecuting criminal cases, you know, and later that year I was promoted to superintendent, and later sent to prosecutions headquarters, where I served as a second in command, looking at the administration of the division to ensure that adequate personnel are posted to the courts, maintaining law and order in the courts, you know, ensuring that we serve court processes, you know, to witnesses and other litigants, you know. Shortly afterwards, I was posted to Bo, also as second in command, because the people who were there at that time had some problems for which administrative action was taken, and I was identified to replace the then officer who was second in command. Yes, I was there after 1 month. The then chief police officer requested to be transferred to Freetown for health reasons, but by then Bo could not be accessed by road. We used helicopters and small aircrafts, West Coast Airlines, which used to fly to take passengers to and from Bo, because there were rebels on the highway. This was the time when ambushes were very frequent on the Bo Mile 91 Mashaka Highway, you know. So like I said, after 1 month, when my chief police officer, who was my immediate boss then, requested for transfer to Freetown, his opinion was sought as who could best replace him, and he recommended me that he thought I would be capable of handling the division. So I was made chief police officer of the then I division, that is the entire Bo district, and Bo is the regional headquarters for the southern province. I was
the second biggest city.
I was there from 1995 to round about the end of 1996. We had a lot of difficulties because there were ambushes all along the route. Food supplies could not come freely. Sometimes the military had to organize food convoys, you know, to provide security from the rebels to bring food, you know. And Bo was well populated because all the other towns and villages have been evacuated because of the fear of rebels and rebel attacks. So they had all come to reside in Bo. All of Pujahun, Moyamba, Bont, Matru, and other towns and villages in the Bo district and the southern province, you know. By then, Bo had a population of over 750,000, you know. I was there when we had the first democratic elections, you know, after the war. And it was those elections that ushered in President Ahmad Tidjane Kabbah, the former president. You know, it was contested by about 14 political parties based on the proportional representation. You know, we had some difficulties because even on the eve of the elections, there was a rebel attack on the township. And after the elections, you know, there was this suspicion that military people, by then they were in governance, the NPRC, you know, there was the suspicion that because the military did not want to hand over power to an elected civilian government, therefore they were posing as rebels. They were then called SOBELs, you know, soldier rebels. Yes. Mm-hmm. So there was a hostile confrontation between the local militias, civil militias, and the military. And it was only the police that could stand as neutral arbiters to restore calm and separate the parties. You know, however, we managed to hold the elections, and Bo which was the stronghold of the SLPP, was the nerve center, you know, in that election. But the SLPP won after a runoff elections, and the handover was effected, you know, when the military finally handed over to the SLPP under the leadership of Alhaji Dr. Ahmed Tidiane Kaba, you know. But I remember when Dr. Alhaji Ahmed Tidiane Kaba, during his campaign tour, met me to pay me a courtesy call, because it was the practice that when political contestants visit an area, they visit the police to let them know that they are there, and to keep them alert in case of any problems or difficulties, they might wish to call in the police for assistance. You know, he did tell us, I mean the police, during that visit, that he was aware of the problems within the police, and that whilst he was a member of the National Advisory Council, he had carried out a study, you know, I think it's the Banya Commission of Inquiry, on the police, the performance and conditions of service for the police. By then he was acting in the capacity of chairman, National Advisory Council. So he was quite aware of the problems, and if elected to office, he would spearhead a restructuring process for the police, you know. So fortunately, he was elected and he became president. At the end of the year 1996, I was transferred briefly to head the research and planning division at police headquarters, a position I occupied for 1 month, and later posted to Putloko and Kambia, where I was in charge of two districts, Putloko district and Kambia district, as chief police officer. Yes, I was there from the 2nd of January 1997. I only left there in 2001. So for another 5 years, I was in Putloko effectively as a chief police officer. And it was during this time that we had the infamous May 25 coup, which brought in the AFRC military junta. Immediately the military junta came to power, they invited the RUF to join them and establish the AFRC government. We had to police, you know, the populace under very difficult circumstances, you know, because the rebels had come from the bush without any reconstruction program, without any reintegration program. They just came, and we had to contend with their unruly behavior. You know, sometimes they would seize things from civilians like they've been used to doing in the bush. You know, they hardly recognized the change between living in the bush and living in town. Mm-hmm. You know, because in town you have to observe, you know, civility, respect for people's rights, you know, people's rights to their property, you know. So we had a very difficult time policing the area, you know. However, with our experience, we managed to survive it all. And in February 1998, there was this intervention force from Nigeria, you know, ECOMOG, you know. And when they came, they worked with us. The ECOMOG soldiers worked with us. But because of the friendly relationship we had built with the military, most of the military, people in my area. I spoke to them not to put up any resistance because we didn't want to see bloodshed in our area. And they agreed. We disarmed them, kept their weapons, and when ECOMO came, we handed over their weapons. So there was no fight in Potlako for regaining the township, you know. So it was the transition from AFRC to back to civilian rule, you know, was not very violent, you know, because there was no resistance. The few that did not heed to our advice, they went to the bush and joined the RUF, the AFRC. They had their faction and they continued fighting, you know. ECOMOC pushed them to the borders, you know. But after some time, the tide turned. It now, instead of ECOMOC continuing to completely annihilate the rebels had the upper hand and they started pushing the ECOMOC forces. You know, they started from Kailan, who came to Kono, then McKinney, and eventually they attacked us in Potlako. However, they were unable to subdue the township since we had elements of Guinean soldiers, you know, under ECOMOC, and they had superior artillery power. You know, they didn't have, you know, the ground troops, the light weapons like the AKs, you know. But their superior artillery did not allow the rebels to enter and occupy Potlako Township. So they had to divert and come to Freetown. And, you know, but at this time we are sending intelligence reports to Freetown that people who are captured by the rebels, and later who escape later, they come to the police to tell us that the rebels are determined to come to Freetown. So Freetown, you better, you know, brace up and provide the required security. But Freetown was always assuring us that everything was in place and that the rebels would not dare come to Freetown. But that did not deter the rebel advance, and on the 6th of January 1999, I normally listen to BBC Network Africa. Early in the morning, there was news that rebels had entered Freetown, and there was big pandemonium because most people have their loved ones in the capital, you know, and a lot of mayhem was reported. But at this time, my personnel and myself went to seek refuge in Cambia, you know, because when we saw the wounded ECOMOC soldiers from Kono walking over 300 kilometers, some of them totally disoriented, you know, we felt that perhaps we needed to find a safe haven, at least temporarily, until something is done. So I took my personnel to Cambia, where we stayed for 3 weeks, you know, until the situation was brought under control in Potlako. We came back to resume police operations, you know. So we had new ECOMOC forces, I mean new Nigerian battalions who came to work alongside with the with the Guineans. Mm-hmm. So there, until the Lomé Peace Accord was signed, there was the ceasefire. I was a member of the ceasefire monitoring committee. We used to meet on a weekly basis with the MILOPS, that is the military observers, you know, working with the military observers to monitor ceasefire violations and sending our reports to UNAMSIL in Freetown, you know, until the disarmament started. But by then we were receiving peace delegations from the UN, from the Commonwealth and other international bodies coming to do assessment studies, you know, which led to the establishment of UNAMSIL force and peace mission. And we started the disarmament. We had the responsibility of policing the disarmament camps, you know, and we also took part in the pre-discharge orientation, you know, where we made presentations to and lectures to the rebels, you know, telling them about differences between living in the bush and living in town, you know, how they need to live peaceably with their fellow citizens, you know, in town, you know, so, before they could be discharged from the disarmament camps, because when they were disarmed, they were demobilized and they were reintegrated, you know, so they were sent to camps where they would spend 2-3 weeks before they are discharged. And thereafter, it was during the disarmament that I was promoted to assistant commissioner when we had the Commonwealth intervention in the Sierra Leone police, and a new British expatriate, a British retired assistant chief constable was appointed to spearhead the police service in Sierra Leone, because they thought at the time they needed a strong leadership, which...
Keith Biddle, British.
Keith Biddle, yes, British, who retired from Kent Constabulary, you know. So he was identifying good people, and by some luck, I was identified for promotion. I was promoted to assistant commissioner and put in charge of the northern province, you know, because the man who was in charge of the northern province feared coming to the region, you know. He was outside the region manning the area, and Kibiru thought it was unacceptable, since I was brave enough to have survived 16 attacks on the township with, there with my men working with Echo Monk. He thought perhaps was the most suited person. So that was why I was promoted and posted as a regional commissioner for the North. I was there for a few months, and I was selected to take part in a training program at Grams Hill in the United Kingdom, you know, a 10-week training program alongside 13 of my colleagues in the SLP. And whilst I was there, I was promoted to be in charge of operations in the police headquarters. So when I returned from UK in April 2001, I was put in charge of national police operations. So I had the responsibility of returning the police after the disarmament to previously rebel-held areas. That also was a difficult task to achieve, you know, because all the infrastructure, most of the infrastructure was damaged, you know, and the rebels who had occupied those areas were very stubborn or recalcitrant to receive police and personnel, because they knew that was the return of civil authority, the return of law and order. So they were very hostile. We had difficulty cajoling them, talking to them, you know, assuring them that we were there to work in the common interest of everybody, and we were not there as agents of the government only, or to suppress them or to investigate what they were doing, but rather to provide reassurance to the returning communities and provide the framework for return of civil authority and recommencement of economic and social life in the areas. With support from UNAMSIL, who was giving us logistical support, sometimes they could assist us with aircrafts to lift our personnel, you know, because during this time, even the roads were not very safe, you know. I had the bitter experience at one time when I was captured by the West Side Boys, you know, at the Okra Hills. But fortunately, I made good my escape before they could identify me. You know, two of my bodyguards were arrested, they were disarmed, you know, and but they also returned unhurt, you know, only that they took away their uniform, their weapons, their arms and ammunition, you know. So it was also a very interesting experience, you know, but thank God we survived it all, you know, too. So I was in charge of operations for another 5 years, you know. We continued the deployment, the redeployment of police personnel, and working with the local government ministry, you know, to return the paramount chiefs, restore civil authority, you know. And I also led an initiative, the Community Arms Collection and Destruction Program, you know, because the DDR had some incentives attached to it. But since the DDR had the commission, had limited resources, they could not go on and on and on to collect arms, you know. And when you look at the fact that there is a proliferation of small arms and light weapons within the West African sub-regions, it was very, very difficult for the DDR Commission, you know, to be able to continue to get people under the disarmament program. So there was a cutoff point after which the rest was to be collected by the police under the Community Arms Collection and Destruction Program, an initiative I led, and we were able to collect 10,000 shotguns, so many rounds of ammunition, some other explosives. Yes. Where did I stop?
I'll remind you at the beginning. Okay. Second part of the interview with Mrs. Francis Allier Mounou. So we were just talking about the when you were heading the Community Arms Collection.
We collected a little over 10,000 weapons and a number of live rounds, explosives, and other munitions. And it was acclaimed as a success. Then after that, we had the problem of policing the refugee camps, because When the Liberian War escalated, there was a large influx of refugees coming from Liberia to Sierra Leone. You know, so we signed a memorandum of understanding. I signed on behalf of the Sierra Leone police, you know, to police the refugee camps. But we had a difficult situation when military personnel came alongside civilians, you know, and it was the policy, it's the policy of the UNHCR that separation takes place, because they don't want to keep soldiers and civilians in the same refugee camps, you know, for very obvious reasons, you know, because some of the soldiers were the very cause for the civilians running away, and some of them had meted out atrocities, you know. So the UNHCR could not cater for the former combatants from Liberia, you know. So we had to lead another initiative to separate the combatants, you know, so as to maintain the civilian character of the refugee camps, you know. So I again led a task force, which we call the internment task force, you know, that was charged with the responsibility of identifying, separating, and transporting and internment of these former fighters. You know, we had fighters from the AFL, the Armed Forces of Liberia. We had combatants from the Lord Forces, and we had combatants from civil militias. You know, we set up two camps for them, one at Mapé, a place outside Lungé, which was originally a camp for the military reintegration program. You know, at the end of the war, some members of the CDF and the REF were recruited into the military, which under the military reintegration program. So they had built a camp outside Lungé at a place called Mapé. So when we had this problem, it was identified as a possible location for interning them. And the internment itself had its legal backing from the Hague Convention of 1907 and the Geneva Convention of maybe around the same year, I cannot quite remember, which talk on combatants entering neutral territory, that the convention imposed a responsibility on the neutral territory to intern them and provide them with clothing, housing, food, shelter, and clothing that is required by humanity. So that was the legal framework we used. But we had our motive as well, because if well-trained people could come to your country and do not have any visible means of livelihood, then that could be a recipe for criminal activities, you know, or that could provide a reservoir of mercenaries, you know. So that was our considerations as well. And it was the government that funded that initiative. I led it. Later, we were able to get a 2 million euro grant from the EU to provide skills training for them, so that when they go back to Liberia, they could become useful citizens. You know, we carried out skills training. And upon completion, when peace returned to Liberia, we worked with the Liberian DDRR to effect a repatriation program for them. Accordingly, we repatriated them, and they settled back to their communities. And as a senior assistant commissioner that was responsible for operations, I was also responsible for the conduct of the 2002 general and presidential elections, you know, which were also very peaceful, and the police was also acclaimed. I provided the goal command, that is in charge of policy, you know, providing support to the regional police commissioners to ensure smooth polling and to police the period before, during and after the elections. And I was also in charge of the 2004 local council elections, you know, because I was still senior assistant commissioner that was responsible for operations. During this time, I attended several conferences at home and abroad, and then I by the end of 2004, we had a rank restructuring. So the post of Assistant Inspector General was created, and it was staffed by people who were then Assistant Commissioners or Senior Assistant Commissioners. So that was how I became Assistant Inspector General. And in 2006, I was transferred from operations to the Personnel and Welfare Department. You know, I was in charge of personnel until 2007, when we had another general and presidential elections. And in October 2007, I was transferred to Crime Services, where I now work as AIG, Assistant Inspector General, that is responsible for crime services. I have the CID, the Special Branch, the Criminal Intelligence Service, the Family Support Unit, Interpol, and the Precious Minerals Intelligence and Investigations Unit under my command. I am presently spearheading a review process to make those departments more responsive to the current needs and future needs, to carry out a retraining program to ensure that they have a proper logistics, and to make sure that we have sufficient personnel to be able to function as a modern crime investigation units and also modern intelligence units, and to open us also to Interpol so that we can have
international
linkages, so that we can be able to deal with international crimes such as human trafficking, drug trafficking, you know, movement of criminals across borders, you know, arms trafficking and the like. So that's a brief background of my work in the police. Let's continue. I'll pull it off so that we try to finish.
Yeah. Third part of the interview with Mr. Francis Aliumunu. So I'd like to ask you now if you could give us, you talked about the review process, you're spearheading the review process, and looking at what crimes, the evolution of sort of the crimes that you're facing. What are the major type of crimes and challenges to public order you're facing today, the SLP is facing today?
Well, generally, if you come to Freetown, you will hear people talking about lawlessness and indiscipline. You know, because we have a large number of school dropouts during the war. We have a high rate of unemployment. People complete schooling every year without jobs. And we have an expanding population. So we have a lot of idle minds, you know. And the reintegration programs were not very comprehensive. So we have a large number of unemployed youths. This is a problem for public order as well as for crime and criminality. We have cases of burglary, robbery with aggravation, or what we normally call armed robberies. You know, that's a big problem. It's a problem now. We still have arms proliferation. We have drug trafficking. Recently, we waged war on people who grow cannabis. And also, West Africa is becoming an important transit point for drugs to Western Europe. You know, because of
coming from where?
Coming from South America, you know, Colombia, Peru, and the other country. And also others coming from Southeast Asia, you know, like Afghanistan, you know, because flights from those areas to Western Europe are suspected, but because they are producing areas. But flights from West Africa, you know, are not suspected, you know, because West Africa is not a drug producing area, cocaine, heroin, you know. And because of strong enforcement mechanisms on the Atlantic route, you know, they decide to come to areas where the enforcement is very weak. So West Africa is becoming very important as a transit point. So we have that problem. We have a problem of human trafficking, you know, money laundering, you know. We also have problems of minor crimes like wounding, assaults, but the major ones are armed robberies, drug trafficking, you know, and money laundering. Human trafficking is not very prevalent, but it's becoming important. But we have a problem of proliferation of arms, though not on a large scale in Sierra Leone because of the successes we achieved in the previous DDR and community arms collection exercise. Yet it is a problem because when you know, we hear about armed robberies taking place, you know, then we know that we still have illicit arms among the population. So, but our investigative machinery, like the CID, is not very much equipped, you know, to be able to combat these problems. That is why when I came over in October, I started work with JSDP, the Justice Sector Development Project, to carry out a review to look at what we want to achieve, whether we have the human resource, whether we have the required training, whether we have the logistics that is required. You know, already you see the new building on Pademba Road. That's the new CID building. So it is my view that if we go to that building, we should go with a modern capability that can enable us to work or function as a modern CID. Mm. Yes.
Meaning with forensics?
Yeah, it is my hope to establish a forensic capability. I am in touch with some organizations that are specialized in that. I made my request. They have sent us some correspondence to answer to certain key questions that they would require answers for in order to move the process forward. So that is about the review process.
You headed the personnel section in 2006.
Yes,
for the Sierra Leone Police.
Yes.
And you mentioned now in part of the review process is also looking at the personnel issue and recruitment. What are some, some of the findings?
Recruitment into the CID. So what I did was to carry out a selection process wherein we set out conditions for eligibility criteria. We advertised into
the Criminal Investigation Division,
the force, as to who wants to come to the CID. and who wants to come to the intelligence branches. You know, so recently we concluded a training of 125 personnel for the CID, new personnel, and 125 new personnel for the CS Special Branch and the Criminal Intelligence Service. You know, so we concluded our induction training, and now we are looking at in-service training for personnel who had been there already in the CID and in the intelligence service departments, so that we conduct a refresher training for them. You see,
whilst
we
needs?
Try to establish an electronic database for the crime services department for criminal profiling and record of fingerprints, you know, for our criminal records office, so that in future, you know, we there's the need to respect human rights during our investigations, you know. And it is my view that if we have an electronic fingerprint database, then when we are able to lift fingerprints from a scene of crime, we can compare them to those in the database, and possibly by stroke of luck we can identify the perpetrators, you know. And the Criminal Intelligence Service can also carry out a criminal profiling, you know, so that we keep record of all hardcore criminals, you know, so that we do not abuse human rights unnecessarily when we have to arrest so many people, you know. When maybe a single person or maybe two people would have been the perpetrators, you know.
Could you describe more in detail the initial training and maybe also the retraining programs you're considering in terms of which topics you focus on primarily? And
well,
how long
the
do
topics
they last?
Are the major topics under current police practice, like the offenses I have identified as the major offenses. You know, some of them require skillful, they require expertise to investigate them, you know, handling gender-based violence cases. You know, we've just recently enacted three gender bills, gender acts that make provision for the registration of customary marriages, the devolution of estates, and the child rights acts, you know. So we require training for them, you know, that is for in-service training, those that are. Then, of course, human rights is one of the softer, you know, policing skills, you know, armed robberies, you know, money laundering, human trafficking, drug trafficking, you know.
How do you evaluate the success of these trainings? Do you see impact in the
well,
the
it's
work
too
of the
early
CID?
To say. It's too early to say because the induction training has just ended. By all indications, they did very well academically, but when it comes to the field, maybe it could be another kettle of fish. So we are yet to see their performance. But in the refresher training, we also want to set standards wherein we carry out a performance monitoring program for line managers to be monitoring the performance of their personnel. You know, we have a monitoring and evaluation unit which we will bring to bear to the CID to ensure that what is in the training program is actually reflected in the performance of the personnel. You know, so all of that will be embedded in the refresher training.
So you said you train 100 new CID staff. How large is the CID unit overall?
Overall is about 400, and that's very small. That's very small. because we need to be accessible everywhere in the country if we are to provide services to all. And, you know, we need to spread the workload so that we do not overburden our CID officers, you know, to reduce the volume of work from one individual CID officer and thereby enhance their effectiveness.
Now, looking at the broader challenges, you already mentioned some of the need for retraining, personnel, logistic support. What would be your top priorities in terms of the tasks in your specific area? And with specific examples maybe of the kind of program you would wish to see?
Well, like I've said, the review process is broad-based, but along four main things. One, the personnel. Two, we equip them with skills. Three, we provide the logistics, you know. And when we talk about the logistics here, I mean, I want to set up a forensic laboratory, because sometimes we depend on Connaught Hospital, where we have only one forensic analyst, and we do not have facilities like DNA, you know, blood sampling, and we have a lot of rape cases, you know, which require a lot of forensic analysis to be able to investigate them satisfactorily, you know. And when we look at other contemporary policing programs, you know, they are more towards a scientific method of investigation rather than relying on the traditional method of taking statements and waiting to see inconsistencies in the statement to determine somebody's complicity. But if we have a scientific method of investigation, then it will go a long way to enhance our competence and our credibility. So then the fourth one is to improve the overall framework, you know, the working environment, you see. And for that, we have the new CID building, which we hope to partition into the various departments within the Crime Services Department. We make sure we provide the necessary IT stuff, you know, to help us to make use of the wide opportunities provided by the development in information technology, you know. Then we got the personnel with the right skills, you know, with the right motivation, so that we can be able to function like any modern CID. Of course, we have a few members of the FBI National Academy. I was fortunate to have attended this year's conference in Jordan, Amman, and we spoke of, you know, regional collaboration, sharing of capabilities, and working together to fight international crime.
And is this materializing in a program? You said the FBI Academy members.
No, I said I attended this year's retraining program for the FBI National Academy Associates. You know, graduates of the FBI have regional associations. You know, we belong to the Africa Middle East chapter. Every year they hold a retraining conference where they share knowledge on current issues in policing and look at how they can collaboratively work together to strengthen regional and interregional collaborations and cooperations, with a view to sharing capabilities, sharing information as to international crime, so that with the combined efforts, the world can be a better, a safer place for everybody.
One last question. Are they, what are some of the major successes, maybe some innovations in your line of work with the SLP that you think merit more attention, that we could possibly learn from? Are there specific programs or changes?
Initially, when you asked me about my policing profile, you know, I gave a number of initiatives which I launched. You know, the first one is like in Potloko, we had 15 attacks. You know, ordinarily, policemen will say, "Oh, as long as there is a military attack, you know." 8, 10, 12 hours attack, then it's no longer safe for police. We better withdraw. But we stayed on to give confidence to the civil populace, because they always look at the police, you know, for confidence and reassurance, you know. So that was one which was acclaimed and which was responsible largely for my promotion from superintendent to assistant commissioner, you know. Then also, working with the military observers to monitor the ceasefire was another initiative, you know. And may I hasten to say that I was the only officer who survived, you know, who was not displaced by the war, in the sense that my headquarters was never occupied by rebels. And there was continuous police service, except for 1 month, when we thought that it was totally unsafe, because we had artillery, you know, bombardments from the Guinean forces, and they do not understand English; they speak French, so there was a communication gap. So we thought it was better we withdrew a little and come back when it's much safer. Then, of course, the community arms collection, which was an initiative to make our community safer, to collect arms, you know, because during the war, arms extended beyond the combatant communities, you know. Even civilians had arms, some of them for their personal protection. Some of them were brought by combatants or relatives of combatants, you know. So that was also a good initiative that we launched. And the separation, of course, of the refugees from the separation of armed elements from the civilian population was also an initiative that was lauded. And the return of civil authority,
And from the recent restructuring of the SLP?
And, well, the recent restructuring of the SLP, that also I took an active part. You know, because conceptually, we got the government to formulate a policing charter that is to tell us how they want the police to function and how they wish to resource the police and how they want the police to look like and what would be their own commitment towards the governance, the management, and the funding of the police. Yes. Then the police, we took part in formulating a policing charter, that is a mission statement, that is how, what we think are our roles, our responsibilities, and our priorities, you know, that is what we say we will do, what we set out ourselves to do. Then we also took part in the formulation of a concept of operations, you know, coming out with objectives and developing a strategic development plan, which, you know, was broken down into annual policing plans, so that every year we review the annual policing plan depending on emerging priorities, you know. We review the rank structure to reflect, you know, job performance. And we also try to empower those are the service delivery level, the constables, the sergeants, you know. We tried to carry out a role differential, you know. The rank structure was linked to roles, you know. And we tried to create new departments like the CDIID to look at internal matters, police excesses, you know, sometimes they talk about police brutality, you know, or police misconduct, or police unprofessional behavior. Then we set up the media to carry us in a positive light in the media, you know, because no matter what
media
we do,
unit.
Yes, a media and public relations unit, you see, because no matter what we do, it is how the public perceives us that is really the question, and it is the media that presents us, you know, that helps to formulate the public view of the police. Mm-hmm. So we took cognizance of that. We set up a corporate services department so as to look at corporate issues, you know, within the SLP. We set up a community relations department so as to enhance our collaboration with members of the public, you know. We practice community policing, you know, and we establish local policing partnership boards, you know. Mm-hmm. Yes, in fact, on Friday I will be leaving for Matru to take part in the launching of the last local policing partnership board. We have a local police partnership board in all divisions. So the Bont division in Matru, they will be launching theirs on Friday or Saturday.
And they meet on community leaders and
They meet periodically to define their policing priorities for their own areas, so that the police there can pay attention to that, because we practice local needs policing. That is policing that meets the needs and expectations of local communities. So in order to realize that, we have TCGs, tasking and coordinating groups, where you have the LUC working with a crime officer, an information officer, a support officer, and an operations officer, then periodically meeting with the local partnership board to identify their policing priorities within their areas. Because, you know, policing priorities vary from locality to locality. The problems we have here might be different from the problems others may have in their own areas. So it is for them to identify their priorities so that the police can allocate their resources appropriately to meet the needs and challenges of those specific areas. So the restructuring has been a long and elaborate process, but with the conceptual framework, we are able to carry it out with commitment. You know, we had some small resistance, but with time, the resistance was cleared, and now everybody is towing the line, and we are moving forward.
Any final comments?
Well, the final comment is that the Sierra Leone police has come a long way. Though we still have a long way to go, we know that with commitment and continued support from the international community, we will get to where we want to. You know, we also took part in a security sector reform program, wherein we identified present and future threats to our security, you know, national security, looking at the borders, looking at the internal security, you know, we look at the unemployment, we look at terrorism, espionage, you know, and we identified future and immediate threats, and we realized that it is ourselves, that is the Sierra Leone police and the Republic of Sierra Leone Armed Forces, that would have to provide the future security needs that people helping us cannot be here for ever, you know, because they also have resource constraints. But we are still embarking on a capacity building to enhance the capacity of the Sierra Leone police and the Republic of Sierra Leone military forces to be able to implement the security sector reform program, you know, that we carried out since 2003. So the future is bright, and we do not envisage a relapse of the security situation, though we have lots of economic challenges due to global trends, you know, like the recent food crisis, the escalation in oil prices. Oil prices continue to be major determinants of our economic stability, you know, and for us, you know, we have fragile economies. Our states are very fragile. Our peace is very fragile. Our democracies are young. We need to build them on firm foundations. And it's only when we have improvement on the economic and social fronts that we can have improvement in the security and development fronts. So in conclusion, I think we've come a long way. We still have a long way to go. But with the goodwill of the international community, we continue to build our capacity so that sooner rather than later, we can stand for ourselves. And we get counted as one of the progressive nations of the world.
Mr. Francis Manuel, thank you very much.
Thank you.